Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Tate Modern. My name is Marco Daniel. I'm convener of Adult Programs. It's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's talk and private view of Liechtenstein, a retrospective. Unfortunately, due to illness, the exhibition co-curator, Iria Candela, is unable to be with us tonight. But it is my pleasure to welcome in her place Richard Thomas. Here he is. Richard is a knowledgeable and established speaker here at Tate, and we're delighted to welcome him tonight to hear his insights into the Liechtenstein exhibition. Richard and I have worked together on many projects, and not least the Miró exhibition, which I co-curated with my colleague Matthew Gale, and it was always such a pleasure to have Richard as our speaker at events around it. I think you will find his insights extremely rewarding and refreshing. Richard will talk for about an hour to us about the exhibition. There will then be some time for questions from you. And after that, at 7:30, we will be able to make our way up to the Liechtenstein exhibition on level two. I'd like to remind you that you have about an hour then for viewing the exhibition as a kind of a private view. It's a really wonderful opportunity, I think, to see the exhibition slightly more, slightly less crowded than it tends to be during the day. So for now, let me just hand over to my colleague Richard, and thank you.
I'm on. Fantastic. There's an irony here. I'll get to it in a moment. I'll just show you a couple of slides. In the first room of the exhibition, we meet art of this nature. And one can be very grateful that in the first room there is some serious art, some real art. What I mean by that is the kind of gesture that is an explosion from the inner self, art derived from the outpourings of the untamed inner self, gestural abstraction. Now, it's very hard to produce authentic gestures from the inner self. If any of you know any abstract expressionists, you'll know that they are on a serious course of drinking alcohol and employing a psychoanalyst for several hours a week. In order to have such authenticity. And if any of you know actors, you'll know how difficult it is to produce spontaneity on stage and manufacture it reliably, so that actors that I know are spending a lot of time watching Big Brother and other reality TV programs so as to rehearse being spontaneous. And there's a serious problem with actually manufacturing spontaneity when it's required. So where does that get us? Well, the best possible abstract expressionist would become a machine of authenticity pouring out the inner self. And Roy Lichtenstein had been an abstract expressionist, and then he found a way of effortlessly printing off the inner self, as you can see in these slides in the first room. So he used Magna Paint, which was an acrylic paint that could be removed completely with terps, so that the appearance would be of something completely effortless. And what one has is a cliché. The appearance of a machine-made image printed. And the word cliché, as I understand from watching humorous programs on TV with a man called Fry hosting them, the cliché is the sound of ink going onto the paper when the stereotype is pressed down. Of course, it doesn't mean that in French these days. The French are very careless with their language and have shifted the meanings. That's an ironic joke. We have clichés by Liechtenstein, or are they? They're paintings of cliché, but they're carefully hand-painted, authentic portrayals of clichés. Subtle difference. I hope you appreciate this and are not too confused. It's rather interesting to analyse the work of Franz Klein and other abstract expressionists. Vast paintings look as if they're carried out with an enormous broom or something of that kind. And Franz Klein had been projecting small drawings onto the canvas and reproducing the look of a gesture. So the manufacturing of gesture was quite an interesting process. This is my favourite one, so I insist on confronting you with that at the risk of killing the show entirely for you and leaving no wonderful surprises in it. I imagine that's why you've come to the preamble, so as to diminish your excitement. this is the nature of Roy Lichtenstein's abstract work before launching onto the procedure that we know him by, and nobody had wanted to interview him in his career up until the time where he was presented to the public after a show at Leo Castelli's gallery in February 1962. Then a large number of people wanted to interview him. Well, he was an abstract expressionist and a friend, an admirer of Willem de Kooning. In the mid-50s, Willem de Kooning was wondering about connecting the forces of the inner self with the imagery that filled the mind from the world in which we live, that is continually bombarding us with images. So in 1954, he was confronting Marilyn Monroe in his work. It's not that much of a surprise to find Donald Duck wandering into Roy Lichtenstein's gestural abstraction. And maybe it just occurs to me, maybe Robert Rauschenberg incorporating printed material into his gestural work would be a relevant reference point too, because at some point, and for some reason, we have nice anecdotes that say that Roy Lichtenstein's son came home from school and said he was being mocked by the other boys because they had found out his dad was an abstract expressionist, which meant he couldn't draw. So abstract expressionism was something people were aware of in the streets. Maybe following on from Life magazine doing their feature on Jackson Pollock in 1949, is this the greatest living painter in the United States? Kind of joke title. No way could he be the greatest living artist producing that kind of stuff. So it occurred to Roy Lichtenstein to make a copy from a children's book, and he made it look cheaper. And the illustration in the children's book, it wasn't a comic strip, it was a fairly conventional illustration, was not inside a rectangle. It didn't look like that kind of cheap illustration. So he made it look cheaper. He put in the gaps that look like bad registering. And he made it look like the kind of material that is available to everybody, that is street-level culture rather than art culture. And he gave that look of the printed image in this example by using a dog grooming brush. As you go around the exhibition, you can become a connoisseur of dots and think about the different techniques you might want to use when producing your own. So the dog grooming brush has a beautifully cheap look about it, a bit messy. And it's used for for Mickey's face. And there's a huge catalogue. If you get the hardback version, it's almost impossible to carry. And there's an interesting essay in there where it is suggested not only do these dots suggest that Mickey is printed and rather rapidly and cheaply printed, but he's blushing. The pinpricks of blood coming to his face. He's blushing because Donald has exposed his derriere. There's a level of meaning in this image I've never heard anyone discuss before. So I'm very grateful to the writer of the essay. So 1961, 1962, abstract art was in the ascendancy across the art world. There was more or less nothing else to discuss, it would seem. But if you took that kind of preoccupation in your head out into the streets, you would find abstraction all around. You turn to the back pages of the cheapest paper and you would find abstraction. Only abstraction not to free one from the everyday world, free one from terrestrial thought for the inner life, none of that. The abstraction you find there allows cheap printing to be done very rapidly, edits out all the unnecessary details, and you come bump up against a very immediate, stark icon for an object. Every last thing you want to buy exists in such an abstracted version. And so there's some irony to be had out of inviting the artists who produce these abstractions to be represented in a gallery. And a powerful abstraction it is that speaks forcefully to the mind. You'll notice here that the dots are in the background, and the means for applying them would seem to be a small piece of aluminium, not very big, that Roy Lichtenstein had drilled holes in and then used as a stencil, but they kept to the background at this stage and the object in the foreground. If you invite that kind of advertising image to participate in the activities of the art world, in those days, many, many artists were trying to step into the shoes of Jackson Pollock. And action painting was still a going concern, remained a going concern into the 1980s, as far as I can make out, from wandering down various streets in East London, where people lived in Acme houses. Here are some action paintings. I'm trying to help you to get these. Do you see the action? And here's another action for the sentimental amongst us. And for the more cool and... anyway, I won't spell it out. So 1962, February, it's work of that kind that was on show at Leo Castelli's gallery. And quite interestingly, Castelli was put on to Lichtenstein by Alan Kaprow, who gets a mention with the Bigger Splash exhibition as the person who wrote about Jackson Pollock and said, where do we go from here? We enter the canvas and we start to have happenings and performances. Much influenced by having attended the lectures of John Cage, which asked, where does music go now? Into theatre. And there was a theatre of painting that had sprung up with the involvement of Rauschenberg, Jim Dine, Tom Wesselman, Kleis Oldenburg, and they generated happenings. So it's someone in that circle who mentions Lichtenstein to the dealer Castelli, and the show got a big reaction. Sometimes exaggerated when people say that Life magazine in 1964 had an article which had the headline, "Is this the worst living painter in the US?" It sounds like he had raised cruel antagonism until you find that he was a friend of the author of that title and had approved the title. So if you want to help somebody and you have an opportunity to put something into print, it's sometimes quite a good thing to make out that the artist concerned is something of a disease, if not a kind of criminal producing the work that they produce. So that brought fame and interest to Edvard Munch, and the Life article helped Roy Lichtenstein. And I won't go into all the details of that. I have to finish this lecture at some point. The dots in the faces of these two are worth examining closely. They are quite blotchy and cheaply done, so it's a bad use of the thin piece of aluminium, and relish it for its cheapness. There's a tendency to refer to these as being Benday dots. Now, that is the reference that Lichtenstein had, only his dots are almost never like Benday dots. Benday dots sit in a grid, and they are quite static in their effect. Roy Lichtenstein's are usually offset, and they create flickering patterns of diagonals, as well as verticals and horizontals, so that there's something somewhat more dynamic and eye-catching about each of the ingredients in Roy Lichtenstein's work. He was not the first artist to have looked to comic books and at billboards in the process of creating art. What he does that's so different is to make it seem like he's done next to nothing to that source. So one can be aware that Picasso and Matisse in the early 20th century had been aware of such sources. Picasso was very enthusiastically reading the Katzenjammer Kids as given to him by Gertrude Stein in the early years of the century, something that his dealer was at pains to ignore. Mr. Kahnweiler had studied philosophy and wasn't that enthusiastic about the Katzenjammer Kids. He had a greater enthusiasm for Immanuel Kant. And, if you had the choice, I imagine you would go for Immanuel Kant. And so he launched a version of cubism that was attached to the analytical and the synthetic terms from Kantian philosophy. He overlooked the vitality that comes from the explicit qualities of shape and pattern and line in the cartoon, which has no interest in creating a trompe-l'œil effect and speaks directly to the feelings, and not always very serious feelings. So nothing for the analytical. This picture reminds us that we are looking at a painting, that it is in an art gallery, that though it seems like the culture of everyday street level, it's replacing the serious culture of art with its freeing from fixed meaning, with its meditative detachment. Just the word masterpiece helps, doesn't it? So, that was in a book that Roy Lichtenstein was very fond of when he was a teenager, and that painting in particular he held to be a major reference for him. So I'm asking that picture to back me up in my argument. This is a picture which came from a source called Run for Love, a comic, and has been seriously altered. She is much more intimate than in the source. So let's have a look. And it's a very interesting source. We lose the unattractive man floating in the water with the upturned boat and concentrate on the poor woman, poor, fragile, delicate woman who doesn't, who's not concentrating enough on swimming and getting to safety. And her thoughts have been edited by Roy Lichtenstein. So now she is no longer saying, "I don't care if I have the cramps." It's "I don't care," which is more wonderfully ambiguous, gives us rather more to do and think about. We don't have to think about her cramps now. We can think about other things. And "I'd rather call Brad for help" is obviously a huge improvement on calling Mal for help. I think you all agree, except Mal. So do you notice what the designer of the comic strip has been thinking about? It's committed a theft. Look at the waves behind her hair and the claw-like features on the top of the waves. Where could that come from? Are you getting echoes in your subconscious? So Roy Lichtenstein seems to have recognized something of interest there. He's taken what we call the pregnant moment. Diderot was used as a guide for history painters to seize the pregnant moment from the 18th century on for their elaborate paintings, narrative paintings. So we take the pregnant moment and intensify its impact and launch it into the free-floating imagination. Yes, this looks very good in the exhibition. I struggled to find a good reproduction, and in the end, I resorted to messing about in Paint Shop and trying to marry bits and pieces of online reproductions of a printed version of the painting. So I hope you can forgive me. It seems in the spirit of Roy Lichtenstein to be borrowing and stealing and manufacturing it with the help of machinery. If you don't like this lecture, all I'm doing is effortlessly reproducing what's on the audio guide. So, so after the Second World War, Roy Lichtenstein went to Ohio State University to get a proper degree in art. He had studied in New York before the war. During the war, he attempted to visit Picasso at the Rue des Grands Augustins, but Picasso had seen quite a few GIs and had closed his door by the time that Lichtenstein turned up. So he came back to New York, still interested in Picasso, and went down to Ohio to get a BA in art, and was taught by a man called Hoyt Sherman, who did a very odd thing with his students. He would try to train them into capturing a unified vision of spatial complexity. So we could try this out here, but I haven't done any preparations. You plunge the whole place into darkness, and while it's in darkness, pieces of furniture are suspended on strings and ropes. So then the light is flashed on and you see a complex space which is quite unfamiliar, and you try and capture the whole, sum it up. So he was very concerned about how artists integrate their pictorial space. And so when you're in the exhibition and you look at this, do stand there thinking about how your eye dances from colour to colour, and the different shapes and colours speak to each other, and so do the angles in the picture. And then you will be looking at this in a seriously artistic way. Of course, it is also possible you will be shooting people out of the sky, especially after working for a whole Monday, I'm sure, and travelling through the cold and the London traffic. You're allowed to do that. Now, Roy Lichtenstein says that he became quite aware that he was asking one canvas to shoot another at an early stage of making this image. And up in the exhibition, we offer an opportunity to understand his procedure. We have a copy of the All-American Men of War comic, and at the bottom of the right-hand page you find this illustration, which gives the simple, the very graphic simplification, the graphic device that represents the complex explosion, and a lively quality of shape, but it doesn't have any great refinement to dwell upon. Now, Roy Lichtenstein drew from that, and then he claims he did not look back at the original source. He wanted a meaningless source, something that's there, repeated over and over, meaningless, and take it somewhere. And so we have the drawing that he made, and you can see that he's elaborated the quality of line, especially around the explosion. And then he projected that onto the canvas, that drawing, and then worked on the canvas for the following 2 weeks. So we end up with something that opens up in a non-literal way. Roy Lichtenstein has commented on how an artist will tend to make things leave their literal domain. And so we're familiar with this anyway. We don't need artists to tell us that. I suppose we do. There's a bit of a poet in us, isn't there, when we go to the Chelsea Flower Show and you say, what a wonderful explosion of colour. No, you don't say that kind of thing. Too much of a cliché? Is that the problem? So this opens like a flower, and it's also an untamed explosion on that canvas, which turns the pilot, possibly over Korea or some such, into an abstract expressionist. Very unusual source for an authentic abstract expressionist, a man in a fighter plane. But this is on the scale of a large public abstract expressionist work. Definitely intended to be read that way. And explosions turned into beautifully simple graphic devices have been with us for quite a long time in everyday culture. So these posters are now treasured items in the Museum of Modern Art's collection. Well, I think it's relevant to mention Reginald Marsh, with whom Roy Lichtenstein studied before going to war as a GI and before he went to study with Hoyt Sherman. And he's one of those American scene painters who insisted on an art that was not just about things for the gallery, but very much of life on street level. So I think it's worth a mention in the catalogue, so I'm making up for that. I hope you're enormously impressed and very grateful. Might not be. Goodness, I didn't know I was going to do that next. So when you step into the cinema, you have a taste of the future. Do you recognise we were outside a cinema there? Can you remember cinemas? Yeah, good. In the 50s and 60s, Art Deco became the look of the future in sitcoms, and especially American sitcoms and cartoons even. If you wanted the modern look, the future look, you used Art Deco style. So it's a style that is easy to manufacture. Roy Lichtenstein has called it cubism for the home. And anyone with set square dividers, the usual geometrical instruments, can manufacture a geometrical version of Art Nouveau. And there you have it, the look of the future, a cliché that surrounds us. It's there in all the cinemas and on all the sitcoms. So there's a room where you have a wonderful opportunity to feel as if you're in the cinema. Anyway, with that one, you can almost, the one before, with this one with the velvet rope, you can almost see the person struggling to carry their Oscar past, flooding the place with tears. But, look. Yes, I'm not meant to show you this. Try and forget that there's anybody who's done anything at all similar to Roy Lichtenstein some decades before. You know, when you read those stories about Andy Warhol bringing in his helpful friends to advise him, should he, with his Coca-Cola bottle, get rid of the drips or have the cool, hard look? There are plenty of examples in art to suggest you can do modern subject matter and not have drips, especially in American art. So, but I'm not meant to give you a thorough art historical lecture. So, are you familiar with Lucky Strike? Say no, or I'll start thinking you're one of those. Is the packet which had the odd cigarette of marijuana in it? Anyway, now you get it. Lucky Strike. I'm here to educate. So Art Deco style was informed by artists who were called purists in part. So Fernand Léger and Jeanneret, who was known as Le Corbusier, were thinking about a version of cubism that was harmonious, balanced, and seemed to be based on underlying mathematical order and harmony. And they wanted to produce an art that would speak to modern architecture and design and transform the mood and atmosphere of the spaces in which it was placed so that they shaped up and got with it and positive about being in the modern world. So I've given this the title Roy Lichtenstein's Cubist Still Life, but it looks very like a Léger picture. So of this kind, to my way of thinking, that looks very like it. No? Except a cliched version. So does that look anything like a Picasso to you? It's a really poor quality Picasso, isn't it? You will find that Roy Lichtenstein doesn't go very far in the direction of Picasso. Picasso makes a journey all the way to the street and to the back pages of the newspapers, and a cliché version. I took around a group of people from a distant country the other day, some people from China, and I wanted to know which Western artists they were familiar with. So I asked, do you know Damien Hirst? And no. So I was a bit surprised, because they were museum directors in China, not just anybody. And so I said, Picasso? And they said, yes, everybody in the whole world knows Picasso. So Picasso is definitely street-level idea of modern art. And Picasso was very aware of being a cliché. In the 50s, he was talking of killing Picasso, being his objective. And also an artist who knew about putting meaning and value in question all the time, and challenging people and making everyone aware that they were being tricked into giving meaning and value to things that reminded them all the time that they were just cheap materials, clumsy shapes on a two-dimensional surface. Now, the thing about putting matter into art is that you put that matter in question. If you do an elaborate realist picture. It's on a flat canvas, so the reality is in question throughout. Whatever you put into the realm of art is going into an environment which is highly self-conscious and critical. So Picasso played on that a lot and was a very interesting reference point for Lichtenstein. He held him to be the central reference point. And Cubism in particular, he felt to be the closest art to his own direction. And so this putting comic strip material, everyday material, into the domain of art and putting it on a monumental scale doesn't answer any questions. It poses some, and it's quite inconclusive. And the questions stay alive for many people, even people who wear Roy Lichtenstein ties. So people thought that he wouldn't attempt to take on Monet. Monet's paintings have nothing in common with that cartoon style. But he doesn't take on Monet. He takes on the reproduction of Monet, the over-reproduced Monet. And so these are actually better than the originals, aren't they? But Monet started to attack his paintings with the ones he still had, with his penknife, saying they were looking too mellow and old masterish. Now, when he had seen Cubism and Fauvism and things like that, these pictures looked painfully of the past. So you ask people what modern art looks like, and they might start describing things that look like this. They might know the name Picasso and they might know Monet, but the general idea of generic modern art, you might get things that are described rather like that. And I thought I'd throw in a Tom Wesselman just to confuse the issue, because he was quite aware of the theatre of life containing art within it, a debased version of art, which is the only art we have in our heads, isn't it? Debased version? I have a very debased mind. So here's, for the connoisseurs in the room, a laughable version of Mondrian. Look at that vertical on the right-hand side. Doesn't that tickle you? There can't be any Mondrian with a vertical that does that. Good, I'm glad I'm in knowledgeable company. And the dots that make the areas of grey, hugely entertaining. Oh, well. This is the least Roy Lichtenstein picture in the show, and it's huge, so enjoy looking at it. It takes on a subject which has been a focus for many an art historian over the centuries. We have the sculpture that was uncovered in the time of Michelangelo, the Laocoon, the priest from Troy who warned the Greeks about the horse and warned the Trojans about the horse and said, do not receive gifts from the Greeks. And so he was punished by one of the gods. I confidently told a gentleman on Saturday that this was Apollo who sent the snakes, and he looked at me and in a frightening German voice said, it was Poseidon. So I said that I was just repeating what's in the catalogue. and he smiled. But I think he was disappointed, actually, that he couldn't torture me. Anyway, this is a painting about torture. The snakes have been sent to drive the priest into a frenzy, and you can see a frenzy of untamed brush marks cascading across the surface until you analyze them, that is, and then you realize, oh, down in this bottom corner, there's some brown brush marks and one going vertically across a black splodge behind it, except the black isn't behind it. It's been painted to look as if it's behind it. And the more you examine the picture, the more you discover that the little dot of blue on the piece of dark green, the dark green has been painted around the little dot of blue, the dark blue behind the light blue. You will find as you analyse this picture that it is not at all a gestural cascade made in a frenzy. It's very carefully fabricated to look exactly like that. So we're back in similar territory to the work in the first room of the exhibition. Goodness, time flies. Hurry up. So in 1973, Lichtenstein started painting studio pictures, and his own work had turned into clichés, decor for modern homes. And it's kind of interesting that he's painting Mickey and Donald, because he hadn't exhibited them at that stage. He kept that picture back. When you look at that painting, you can see the corrections. It doesn't look like an effortless printing off. It was the one he did in his studio that told him that there was a power in that kind of language of painting that was a challenge to abstract expressionism. It made all his other work look like mush. So that had confirmed him in the idea of taking this up, and also freeing him from that burden of intensity that he was meant to have as an abstract expressionist, opening a door to somewhere occupied by John Cage and Rauschenberg and others, a wonderful detachment from that burden of passion. So in this picture, there's a beautiful accidental dialogue created between the images. Donald is now telling Mickey that he's hooked Curly Grogan, a member of the mob. Which seems a very unlikely thing for Donald to be involved in. You seem thoroughly familiar with the idea, I don't know. Anyway, there's that dialogue going on there. And then, do you recognise Matisse's sculpting stand and some other objects in the room that, in a Matisse painting, would be on top of that sculpting stand, some plants or some fruit? And in the preliminary drawings, they did occupy the stand, but they've been banished to the floor to make way for the telephone. And I should really, if I was preparing this lecture properly, have got a picture to show you of the painting of the telephone with the ring, ring written across the surface, so that Roy Lichtenstein supplants the debased version of Matisse. There's another little joke in this picture. I don't know if it, joke is quite the right word. An undermining question raised about minimalism. Do you see the moulding along the top of the wall? Roy Lichtenstein had started to make entablatures and architraves and things with complicated names from architecture like that. And he had achieved this by going to Wall Street and photographing the classical looking buildings in Wall Street. So classical buildings at the service of commerce and finance, a debased version, neoclassicism. And then he wasn't painting directly from it. He was doing he made paintings from drawings based on photographs, based on the architecture, which is a debased version of the true architecture which exists in Europe long, long ago. So it's instead of doing the good Donald Judd approach, which is to have the craftsperson manufacturing with their deep understanding of the materials, creating an idea which can be produced endlessly from an artist's input of a concept of how to work the materials. And Roy Lichtenstein was showing, yes, I found some of that in Wall Street, up on these bank buildings, and then in people's homes. And there's an uncomfortable suggestion that the fringe on the bottom of the settee satisfies the same requirements of art. So a debased version of minimalisms. I can never say that right. So just to help you to bring Matisse to mind, and so that you can look at some proper art. There you are. And one thinks how Matisse, on one level, was thinking about equating a painting with a printed material. So there is a parallel to bring to mind. There's meant to be sympathetic pain experienced by monkeys and people. If you see somebody bump their toe, you feel it yourself. So if somebody takes medication and puts it on their toe, do you share their feeling of relief? Is it an uplifting thing to have a painting of someone applying foot medication? Next to the foot medication picture, there is a generic abstraction. So this is the kind of abstraction that was launched by people with revolutionary ideas wanting to suggest a new order taking hold in the world and using geometry, the language that could be understood across the world, whatever culture, geometry would speak of the ordering human mind. And by taking the lines away from the vertical and the horizontal, and making them bounce around the edges of the canvas, they lead to a dynamic geometry unleashed from the vertical and the horizontal hold. But it's turned into decor for modern homes. So it goes very nicely with your grand designs type kitchen. No, steel kitchen. Popova and Rodchenko and others, Malevich, thoroughly at home in the modern world. No need for a revolution. Although Malevich was very interested in pointing beyond the terrestrial to the infinite dimensions of the mystical reality that the revolution was meant to bring into play in Russia for him. But there you go. So there's a room in the exhibition where you can figure out how to make your own perfect paintings filled with this kind of dynamic geometry. So you take the vertical and the horizontal, and or you take lines away from both of them, bounce them off every side, and you get a jumble of triangles and other geometrical shapes, and just fill in one or two colours and patterns to speak powerfully to each other. Or if you are filled with revolutionary fervour, you may find that your shapes escape the rectangle, as do the imperfect paintings, where the pale yellow comes outside of the edge of the canvas. And there are just a couple of examples here, but it's wonderfully exciting to see the uncontained energy of these geometric shapes. And the artist managed to persuade the canvas to alter its dimensions to capture those. That didn't work at all. Oh, I didn't know I put that there. This is, have you ever asked a mirror to tell you the truth? Mirrors usually hide behind a facade of other things and do not usually tell the truth about themselves. No? If in the age of Donald Judd and Kenneth Nolan and others, there was a vogue for the kind of art where things spoke of their own materials and of their own making and didn't hide behind a language of emotional content or objects in someone's mind. They just were themselves, and their shapes announced that they were objects. So have you ever asked your mirror to, come on, just be yourself? It's an interesting process. It's also linked, in this case, to him being aware of René Magritte as a common knowledge, everyday culture kind of artist. And there's another painting I could show you with a lump of cheese floating above, but it wouldn't be appropriate to the theme of the room in which this picture hangs, which is all about mirrors and art as the mirror of nature. So Leonardo had talked of art as the mirror of nature. So if you ask art to be true to itself and the mirror to be true to itself, that's what you get. I hope you enjoy that room. And maybe you'll want to buy some suitable merchandising. So let me hurry to the end of this exhibition. You'll wonder why this room is so animated that even the Monet water lilies come to life. There's a clue down in the bottom right-hand side. Do you see something with long flowing hair leaving the space? Maybe an atmosphere has been generated. This was based on a large billboard he saw in 1989 on the outskirts of Rome. He had been to Italy to look at art, and at last, on a billboard outside Rome, he found something that spoke to the modern world, and he drew from it and produced this admirable masterpiece as a result. Now, I came along on a Sunday afternoon, the Sunday before last, to have a look at the exhibition. It is the worst possible time to come to the gallery and look at art. Sunday afternoon, especially when there's bad weather, everybody who can't think what to do with themselves on a Sunday afternoon crowds in here. And it was jammed, and you were forced to listen to everybody's opinions because you couldn't get any distance between you and anyone else. And the room with the nudes, there was a lot of moaning and discontent. So if you like moaning and discontent, come Sunday afternoon and go to this room, because people are very troubled by the use of women in these pictures, of course. And they are paintings which yet again highlight how unreal they are. The dots are quite varied here. They're nothing like Bende dots now. These are half-tone type dots, but on a huge scale. So they're very conspicuous, and they float across things without explaining any differences between objects. And then the pale yellow links wall, curtain, and figure against two blocks of blue and these red dots on the right. And they have a strange expansive quality, with the varied quality of line being something else to dwell on and move on round the shapes. So something a little bit trippy, because these are on an enormous scale. And you'll delight in looking at the green eyes and the green picture frame and the green on the necklace. It's got a bit of a zing in the actual picture. He had taken some of his archive romance comics and liberated the women from their clothing, is the most positive way I can say it. So what you get is nothing like a conventional painting of the nude, with the usual goings-on between the artist and the nude. There's a kind of narrative that remains really weird intact, but now shifted into the weirdness domain, which is free from the usual narrative around a couple of women with their clothes on in a room. Well, in my mind, that's the case, but it may be perfectly normal to you. I don't know. And then this one is huge, and the flat device for the beach ball plays against your knowledge that that's a rounded thing, and the roundednesses in the picture undulate without explaining the bodies. It's all very unreal. And this is what he was doing in the last few years of his life. He died quite suddenly in 1997 from pneumonia. And the last room of the exhibition has a beautiful arrangement of pictures which is based on his interest in art of this kind. While he was at Ohio University, he had access to Chinese art, and he retained an interest. And the idea of the Chinese artist is to paint nature dissolving into the infinite, pointing towards the infinite expanses of time and space, with tiny figures perched on the rocks, revealing their immensity and the immensity beyond the illusions of nature, the eternal dimensions. So Roy Lichtenstein ruins all of that. He takes a printed version. He makes it look like he's effortlessly run this off his machine. And you see the tiny philosopher down in the right-hand corner and the infinite expanses. Now, the Chinese artist is meant to reveal Pingdang, the subtlety that hides any mastery, nothing ostentatious, to point beyond themselves to nature and have nature point beyond itself to the eternal and infinite. And the Chinese master is evaluated by looking closely at their brushwork. You can see the authenticity of their inner being revealed in the gesture of the brush mark. So, unfortunately, Roy Lichtenstein didn't learn from Rauschenberg's dreadful mistakes, where Rauschenberg combined brush marks with cheap printed material and made it look a mess. And so Roy Lichtenstein has no mastery whatsoever, or if he has, it's impossible to see it in these works. And all I can do is say this takes you back to the first room in the exhibition. It links to that. And and apologize on behalf of Roy Lichtenstein that if he had any mastery, it's completely hidden. Oh, you might want to see his face, because he's hidden throughout. So now you can go and look at art. instead of sitting in pulmonary pink environment.